Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, July 1st. This is the 69th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an outstanding chef, sustainable food pioneer, and author, and I will introduce him in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to take initiatives. Be a leader. Seek solutions to problems and aim to make a difference. Oftentimes, we get caught up in our own agendas and forget that there's a larger world out there with bigger issues that we perhaps can help. So be aware of what's happening around us and take action on things that you believe in. Strive to make the world a better place. That's my tip today. Now, I'm really honored to have my guest joining us today. It is Michelle Nichon, the founder, CEO, and president of Wholesome Wave, an organization that strives to create a vibrant, just, and sustainable food system. Michelle is a renowned chef and leader with over 30 years of leadership experience. He is a three-time James Beard Foundation Award winner, including Humanitarian of the Year in 2015. He also owned an operated dressing room, a homegrown restaurant located at Westport Country Playhouse, along with his partner, the late actor Paul Newman. Now, I could go on and on with more accolades and accomplishments, but let's say hello to Michelle. So, are you out there, Michelle?
I am here, and I love your PR tip of the week. That was fabulous.
Well, thanks. You inspired it.
That's so funny.
Well, you did, because I think you do take initiatives, and you're a leader for sure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Sherry. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad to have you on the show. I'm sorry you weren't able to make it out here to Bushwick, but you know, having you call in is just as wonderful, except next time we'll get you out here for some pizza and have some personal time.
I love it. Thank you.
So when I was looking at more of your background, I know you grew up in the Midwest and you had a large family. So what, and I saw something about your mom, how you credit her for your interest in farming and nature. So I wanted to see if we could start with that, a little of your background and if all that's true.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, first of all, my mom was one of 13 children in a south central Midwestern farm family. She was from Morley, Missouri, which is in the boot heel right along the Mississippi River. And she and all of her brothers and sisters, all my aunts and uncles, were expert cooks, fishers, butchers, et cetera. They were farmers, so their whole life was spent, you know, raising food and properly preparing food. So it was just a life skill. So I was really, really lucky to be brought up in that type of an environment.
Yeah. So how did you then get into cooking, and what was your first job? Where?
Well, you know, it's so funny because it actually was a defense mechanism. It was a strategy to eat. I really wanted to be a musician, and I was out playing the club circuit. My mom and dad fell on hard times when right around the time that I graduated high school, so I had to move out of the house. But my mom said, you know, get a job in a restaurant because you know how to cook. At least you'll eat. And I did. So my first job was at a truck stop on the Illinois-Wisconsin border. It's called Center's Truck Stop, and it's still there to this very day on Russell Road.
Ah, good to know.
Yeah, well, I can't vouch for the food. It's been a long time.
Okay. And then were you just drawn into cooking in the industry?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing led to another. So it was easy for me to get the job at Centers. It was close to where I was living in Antioch at the time. And the guy who owned the truck stop was in the weeds because a bunch of people had walked out. So I was working there, and he had a nephew of his who was working for a famed restaurateur in Chicago named Gene Sage. And, you know, this guy was watching me work, and he said, "Wow, you really got skills. You should come down and work with me. We're opening a restaurant in Arlington Heights," which is a suburb of Chicago, by the way. You know, and if you come down and you help us there, it's $2 more an hour. I'm like, right on, man. I'm in. So I went there, and then within a very short period of time, they had a chef, John Vates, an Alsatian guy who was their chef at their French restaurant in the city called Mon Petit. And he liked my skills and said, "Why don't you come work with me at Mon Petit after we get this place open? It's $2 more an hour." I'm like, wow, I like this cooking thing. So that was starting in 1978, and by 1981, I was the chef at a French restaurant in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, called the Fleur-de-Lis. I moved pretty rapidly because I had all of those skills that at the time no American cook really had. I mean, the French Culinary Institute was just really up and running, had not moved yet to Hyde Park, you know, was really more of kind of like a trade school, you know, for the culinary industry and stuff like that, though they were starting to take hold, but they weren't putting out the graduates like they are today. So I lucked out. I did it by the school of eyes open, ears open, mouth closed, hands on.
Yes, you did. And then how did you end up in New York? Because I remember Heartbeat. And
right.
I was a big fan of that restaurant in Midtown. So what led you there?
Well, you know, I was in a restaurant in Connecticut called Mishmash, and very, very frustrated with the partnership. But also during that time, my son Chris was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you know, back in 95. And I really started going through this kind of personal and professional turmoil once I learned that what I did with Chris's food would have more to do with his long-term outcome than anything else. And I started really researching and working on what our food strategy was going to be for Chris at home. I realized that I was feeding customers some stuff that I wouldn't feed my son, maybe. So, you know, I was going through, you know, a bad partnership, all this wrangling with Chris, and I met Drew Nieporn at the Beard Awards. I think it was 95 or 96 that he, like, swept the awards. And, you know, he and I, you know, he had just opened Nobu, and the New York Times, when it used to be on Wednesday, did a piece on our gospel brunch. And we were actually on the cover. And then when you turn to the inside, where the story continued, was the thing of the opening of Nobu. So when Drew saw me, he goes, "Mishmash." He didn't even know me, you know. He's like, "Mishmash." And I turn, and there's, like, Drew Nieporn, this guy who just won all these freaking James Beard Awards. You know, he's like, "We got to talk, brother." So we ended up talking, and he said, "Why don't you come down into the city, you know, be my chef de cuisine at Tribeca Grill." He said, "You know, look at me. I got my own health problems and stuff like that. I believe that, you know, there's a concept in this that we should come up with a restaurant where anybody, no matter what their health condition is, can have anything they want off the menu, other than having a food allergy, you know, that they could order anything and never have to worry about their health condition." And that's what led to the opening of Heartbeat. And we did that. We opened, I think, like November 1997. So that was a while ago.
It was, but you, as with, I think, everything you do, you're a leader, and I think that was a leader in this healthful eating, which has become a lot more popular now, but back then, I think it was, I remember it as one of the only restaurants that was delivering very healthful, delicious food.
Yeah, I think we might have been the only, actually. It was really hard to find folks to kind of riff off of, you know, which I was hoping for. You know, I didn't want to turn over a ton of stones, but we did. And it's so funny. I appreciate you saying it's leadership, but to me, I look at it as I'm just trying to be responsive. You know, you see something going on. If you really believe in hospitality, you know, when you learn certain things about food, you know, and you're feeding tens of thousands of people through your business, you know, I would hope that most people would say, hey, you know, maybe I need to take a look at what I'm doing and do it a little differently, you know. So,
right.
So thank you for that, though.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, so I need to find out a little about how you met Paul Newman and how the dressing room came about.
Okay, sure. So, you know, I had left Heartbeat, I think it was like 2002, and started working towards more sustainable change. I really was itching to do something, start a nonprofit. I was doing consulting work for Song Airlines. They were the first airline to do food for sale. They're,
are you there?
I am. Can you
okay.
hear me?
It went blank for a minute, but now I can hear you.
Okay, that's odd. So anyway, sorry about that. So anyway,
that's okay.
I started working for Song Airways, Delta Airlines, designing their food for sale, which was organic, healthful food. I had a project in India. They wanted a restaurant just like Heartbeat in India, Taj Hotels. So that was a 6-year project. And I was doing a lot of supply chain stuff. I consulted for the International Culinary Center when it was French Culinary Institute to help them look at more sustainable sourcing and stuff. I really wanted to see more scalable change. I didn't feel like I could just do it in a single restaurant. And I also was having trouble with Heartbeat. Once I started understanding, you know, a lot of the, you know, the challenges that people with type 2 face. So I'm in this consulting thing, and I get a call one day by Nell Newman, who, you know, she and I know each other from the organic sustainable movement, and she tells me her dad wants to open a restaurant. This is like 2003 or 2004, and says, I really need you to help my dad. And I said, well, you know, Nell, I really just kind of got out of the restaurant business, you know, but I'll be a free advisor. So for about a year and a half, he was interviewing operators, and I was going to be the guy that was going to help them source locally and teach them how to do it in ways that they could still have a strong bottom line. And they kept disqualifying themselves, not because they didn't want to follow any protocols that we were setting, but because they you know, Paul was very, he loved meatloaf. He was a simple-minded guy, you know, when it came to food, burgers, meatloaf, really great fish, super simple. And everybody wanted, you know, to do like quail and foie gras and refused to put burgers on the menu. So after about a year and a half, he just looked at me and said, would you just do this damned restaurant with me? And by then, we'd become buddies. I'd completely fallen in love with the guy. So he had become very impossible to say no to. So that's how we started the thing. So we opened in October 2006, and it was just an amazing experience.
Yeah, I'm sad I never got out there because I don't have a good excuse for why I didn't, because I just kept reading about it and hearing wonderful things. So, yeah, that's on my regret list, but...
that's all right. I can still cook the meatloaf.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. So then let's get into Wholesome Wave, because that is something you founded in 2007. I read with Gus Schumacher and with Michael Batterbury, who I know because I had an internship at Food Arts back in 1999. And so I just feel very grateful that I did get to work with Michael and know him.
Yeah, he's such a good man. You know, it's interesting. You know, I was had dabbled with being on the board of Chefs Collaborative and worked with some other organizations, nonprofits, because I really felt that white tablecloth restaurants were not going to change the food system. I think white tablecloth restaurants like Heartbeat, like Savoy, Back 40, Frontera Grill, real pioneers in opening the conversation up and really highlighting and turning people on to just the beautifulness and the deliciousness and the cultural importance and relevance of good local artisanal food, you know. But it's just such a small segment of the marketplace. And, you know, I was expressing my frustrations to Michael, and he said, start your own organization, Michelle. You know, you got a voice. You have some great ideas. Do your own thing. So I started dabbling around. And that's when he introduced me to...
Okay, we're going to take a little break here. It's about time for a break anyway. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Hello out there. It's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Welcome back to Own the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Michelle Nichon, the founder, CEO, and president of Wholesome Wave. We cut off a little bit there, but Michelle, are you back?
I'm here.
Okay, good.
Technology, what can you say?
I don't know, but we'll get through this. It's all good. So we're talking about Wholesome Wave. So
yeah.
So Michael,
Michael encouraged me to do kind of my own thing. So he introduced me to Gus. We started doing some hobby stuff, and it started out with like some supply chain work and all that good jazz. And by the time 2007 rolled around, I tried to found it like back in 2002, 2003. And then I opened Dressing Room Restaurant, and it gave me that opportunity because, the restaurant itself, when Paul and I founded it, we're 50-50 partners. His 50% was going to go to support the Westport Country Playhouse, and my 50% I could use for whatever, advocacy I wanted or just keep the money. So I founded the Westport Country Playhouse Farmers Market, started doing some other stuff, but that's when I really realized that lack of affordability was like the biggest barrier for underserved consumers who are struggling with things like type 2 diabetes. Almost 20 million Americans are either pre-diabetic or have those indicators that are going to either lead to some kind of heart disease, or diabetes. Just underserved Americans alone. So it's a big number. So we started raising private money. I founded the organization and was the sole employee. Gus and Michael were my board. And we started doubling the value of food stamps when they were spent at farmers markets on locally grown fruits and vegetables, just so that we could feel like we were doing something, kind of a minimally viable product approach, and then put it out there in the space and see what happened. And it exploded. It just went wild. It went nuts. I think in 2007, we were in one market. In 2008, we were in 10 farmers markets in 3 states. And by 2010, we were in like 20 states, 250 farmers markets, and the phone was ringing off the hook with people wanting us to go into their state and do their program. And just last year, the Farm Bill passed with $100 million to double food stamps when spent at farmers markets and participating grocers on local and regionally grown fruits and vegetables. So, the kind of like this little kind of cool idea turned into a real thing, so we're really pleased about that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty amazing.
Now, talk with the mission of Wholesome Wave. I know you're about affordable, healthy, local food for all. What are the other initiatives? And how are you going about implementing as you've grown since 2007?
Well, it's interesting because our kind of like a long range kind of mission that goes along that vision of good, affordable, healthy, local food for all is that we believe that underserved consumers are a very powerful force. We believe that when they encounter affordability, they become a very, very powerful market force. So just in food stamps alone, 50 million Americans spend $80 billion in food stamps every year, and then they match that with a dollar of their own. So it's a $160 billion consumer marketplace. So just imagine what would happen if these consumers could afford to choose to spend that money differently. You know, so it, there's a lot of power in that. And we really believe that, that is going to become the truth, that these underserved consumers can become heroes of a changed food system. So, you know, we do it through affordability programs like the Double Value Coupon Program that I just explained. That targets farm bill policy. And then we have a fruit and vegetable prescription program, Sherry, where we work with doctors and nurse practitioners in four public hospitals in New York City, community health centers all over the country, including in the Navajo Nation, where doctors and nurse practitioners will diagnose a patient as you know, pre-diabetic, overweight, obese, you know, hypertensive, basically all the comorbidities that are going to lead to a diet-related disease. And then that patient gets a prescription, sees a nutritionist who helps them set healthy weight goals and lifestyle goals, coaching counseling around, you know, healthy food tips and cooking tips, and then they're introduced to participating retailers and farmers markets where they can exchange those prescriptions for free fruits and vegetables, and then to get their refill, they go back monthly, and they're measured for health outcomes. And over a four-year period of time, we've consistently shown that 47% of index patients drop their body mass index within a 14-week intervention. So it's a really powerful program. And there, you know, we're targeting Medicare, Medicaid policy, the Affordable Care Act. There are a variety of policy levers and the billions of dollars that we believe can be shifted towards these families so they can afford to make those healthier food choices that they so desperately want to.
And this is happening all across the country, correct?
Yes, it is. I think we're in 12 states now with the fruit and vegetable prescription program. We're in 33 states in Washington, D.C., through our National Nutrition Incentive Network. That's the Double Value Coupon Program. We expect that to grow. You know, in the next couple of years, you know, it certainly has been the trend so far. You know, so we've added some heft to our executive team at Wholesome Wave. We're increasing the capacity of our board. We are a growing organization, and what we found is that there are some really amazing, like-minded nonprofit partners out there that are leaders in the movement, and we've all begun collaborating together, you know, to really build the energy so that we can say there's a real viable food movement behind this work, so that when we go to the next farm bill, we'd love to see, you know, way more than $100 million to double food stamps at farmers market. We'd like to see it a permanent program, just become normal everyday life in America. If you're struggling because you've hit hard times, you can still afford to put good quality food on the table so that over time your family doesn't get sick and then put a burden on the healthcare costs of the country. So it's a big vision, but we think it's doable. I think everything is solvable through food, and I think more people want good food than what most people assume. So I think it's a great opportunity for us to change the world through food.
I love it. It's so inspiring. I think what you're doing is amazing.
Thanks.
What are the challenges you have mostly now?
As always, because we're a nonprofit, raising money is always
okay.
A challenge.
Yes.
It's one of those things. It's not like coming up, you know, with an awesome new product, you know, like the electric toothbrush or something as simple as a coat hanger that's widely adopted by the world. So raising money is always something that we have to focus on, but we've got some great partners, you know, like Naked Juice, Food and Wine Magazine, a lot of private foundations, individual donors, Newman's Own Foundation, and the Betsy and Jesse Fink Foundation were founding funders of ours. They're with us all this way. But I think, you know, structurally, one of the challenges that we're having, you know, with Gus as a founding board chair, and he was our vice president of policy for 6 years, he was a Bill Clinton, And so when we were going to work on the farm bill stuff, he really understood the ag language, and I also understood it because I come from a farming family. What we're learning in the public health space and in the medical space, the food and vegetable prescription program, is that it's a completely different language. all acronyms and terminology and all that stuff. So, you know, we're learning very, very handily that not all agencies and departments of the United States government work the same. They're very, very different. So that's a little bit of a challenge for us right now. But, you know, we're addressing that again, you know, by kind of beefing up our executive team and the board. And also just some really amazing partners on the ground, like, you know, New York City's Department of Health, Barbara Turk, who's now the Food Policy Council coordinator for Bill de Blasio's office. You know, we've got some good folks in the governor's office for the state of New York that are really interested in this type of program approach. So we're getting there, but it's definitely a different language and therefore a challenge.
I can imagine. I will give a shout out to your partner Naked Juice for that wonderful brunch that we had honoring you as Humanitarian of the Year in Chicago. It was great. I loved it. It was really cool to be a part of it, and they did a nice job. So speaking of delicious stuff, let me ask you my question from my last guest. I had on Jean-Francois Bonnet. He's the executive pastry chef at Tumbador Chocolate. So I asked him to ask you a question, and he wanted to know, what's your favorite chocolate?
Okay, so I have two. I love green and black.
Okay.
And I love Michel Cluizel, which comes out of South America. They're both organic, and they're both really high quality. I love them.
Okay, fabulous.
How do you like that?
I think it's great. He wasn't sure what to ask you. I had helped him a little bit with that, but
well,
it's always good to know.
So he asked me what my favorite chocolate is. Makes sense.
It totally does. Okay, so we're gonna take another break here and come back. We're going to do my speed round game and talk some industry news. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
And this one's Sunday Night Chicks by Mamarazzi. We'll be right back.
Back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Michelle Nichon. It's time for my speed round game. So, Michelle, what this is I'm going to name two things and you just pick your preference.
Okay.
Okay, so here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat in.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Yes.
Fabulous. Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Oh, boy, tipping. I'm pretty generous.
Okay.
Yeah, the all-inclusive, I'd find myself leaving more tip.
Ah, I got it. So you're like double tipping.
Yeah, well, or you know, yeah, it's not uncommon for Lori and I to leave 25% to 35%. You know, we've been in the business a long time, and servers work really hard.
Well, people in the industry tend to do that. So yes, it does.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised by that either. Okay, how about communal table or chef's counter?
Oh boy, yes, I love them both, man. I can't choose.
Okay. Writing award-winning cookbooks or making award-winning TV segments?
Now, wait a second. That's a trick question.
Well, you've done both. I could add in there, or winning Humanitarian of the Year.
I love the TV thing, because people actually get to see and hear you directly. I kind of dig that.
Okay. A couple more. Newman's Own dressing, sauce, or salsa? Or quality. I could go well, on. There were many
and
more
you
brands.
You forgot to mention popcorn.
Popcorn, I know. I decided to keep it to liquids.
Yeah, they're all good, man. It's uncanny how good his products are. You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, cheese plate or dessert?
Cheese plate.
Manhattan, Brooklyn, Westport, or Bridgeport? I don't even know if those two are different, but they seem different to
Brooklyn,
me.
Brooklyn, Bridgeport.
Okay. They are different towns, right? Westport,
yeah,
Bridgeport.
Yeah, they're cool,
I mean,
man, and they both start
close,
with a B.
Okay, and they rhyme. Okay, that's the game. Great.
Awesome. Hey, did I win anything?
You win a discussion now in industry news.
That's, oh, awesome.
I know. I give big prizes here. so, and me knowing what your favorites are, those are the things you win. Okay.
Cool, good.
So first article I had was in the New York Times. It was on farm waste and animal fats will help power a United jet. And this is talking about how United Airlines is going to be using fuel generated from farm waste and oils derived from animal fats. And they have a $30 million investment with one of the largest aviation biofuels called Fulcrum Bioenergy. I was wondering if you knew something about this or had some insight.
I'm familiar with Willie Nelson, and he's done a lot of really great stuff with biodiesel. And you know, when you look at just the amount of fat waste, and not just animal fat, it's animal fat, vegetable, all kinds of stuff can be converted into fuel that's fat-based. There's a lot of promise there in eliminating that big portion of the food waste. You know, and any fuel burning obviously bears a pretty strong carbon footprint, but you know, if you're leaving a carbon footprint and creating an incredible amount of waste, and you can eliminate either one of those things, you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, it sounded good to me. I'm not that familiar.
Yeah, I think
with
it's pretty
this.
Awesome. Planes burn a lot of fuel, man.
Well, that's it. Was saying that you know it will reduce carbon emissions and pollution, and also help with the cost of jet fuel.
Oh, that's cool. If it reduces emissions, that's actually a lot of progress right there.
Well, actually, I'm now looking back at my notes. I might have gotten that wrong because it says the airlines are increasingly under pressure to reduce it. So don't quote me on that.
Okay, well, we'll wave the magic wand and hope that it ends up being true and we'll follow it. How does that sound?
Yeah, well, it seems like they're going in the right direction. And this first flight they're doing is from L.A. to San Francisco sometime this summer. So
cool.
Cool if anyone's going to be on that. The other article I had was also in the New York Times. It was from last week, and it was on how Manhattan's dining center of gravity shifts downtown. And this was by Jeff Gordonier. And this is something, it's been happening they say it started in like 1995, this revitalization, trying to get people downtown. But I think over the past couple of years, we've been seeing restaurateurs like Danny Meyer and Steven Starr opening downtown. And there's just a lot happening in the financial district and Brookfield Place, Hudson Eats. It's kind of exciting for downtown New York.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, what's interesting, you know, it's something because I know, you know, when Wall Street needed to move, a lot of that was kind of forced by the new technologies and those old buildings. You just couldn't run the Internet. You couldn't run the electric. It was impossible to do business, technologically in those buildings. But they're fabulous buildings, you know, so to really see, you know, that revitalization happening, you know, downtown and see these buildings get repurposed, I just dig it. I think it's fantastic. I mean, that historically, that's like the original New York, you know, is that whole area downtown and Wall Street, you know, those are the original borders of the city. In fact, you know, Gus Schumacher, his great-grandfather farmed on 76th and West End Avenue. It was all farmland, or
really?
76th and Broadway. It was just, Broadway was a road that they used to drive farm goods into the city. It's funny.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, and downtown, I mean, obviously they've it's been hard with 9/11 and Sandy. I mean, it's mm-hmm. been a struggle. And I think even, you know, from guys like Drew, who've been in Tribeca for a really long time. I mean, that was a ghost town when he opened.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot happening down there. It's seems to be the place to be.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that the restaurant industry is leading the way. You know, we're all of us in this business are kind of fearless. So you look at guys like Drew and guys like Danny, they really have defined the city. They've helped define the city. They're really bold thinkers who have done remarkable things. There's no question to the quality and the diversity that they've brought to it. It's exciting stuff.
Yes, it is. Well, terrific. Okay, so we're going to take another break here and come back. I'm going to do my solo dining experience. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This one's Intrigue by Obesity. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience of the week, which this week is brought to you by our friends at One House Hospitality Headhunters. You can follow them on Facebook as well as on Twitter at @one_house and Instagram at One House, and that's spelled O-N-E-H-A-U-S. Okay, so here's the rundown of my solo dinner at Osteria Francescana. The location: in the heart of Modena in Emilia-Romagna region of Italy. The concept: contemporary cuisine in an elegant 12-table restaurant infused with art and design. The chef and owner, Massimo Bottura. Why did I go? Because Massimo is a world-renowned chef whose 3-star Michelin restaurant, which opened in 1995, has been listed in the top 5 at the World's Best 50 at the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards since 2010, and this year ranked number 2, an honor he received in London a few days after my visit. My experience. Well, I was staying in Milan, so I took the train down to Modena, took 2 hours. After a quick cab to the restaurant, I was greeted by a nice and professional staff and seated in one of the small rooms with 4 tables in total. Beautiful art adorned the walls of the minimalistic room, and I couldn't have been happier to be there. What did I get? Well, after debating between the 2 tasting menu options, Sensations and Tradition in Evolution, the server told me that he could make a combination tasting menu so that I would get the best of both. Fabuloso! So, my 12-plus course tasting menu consisted of stunning dishes with clever names, including 5 ages of Parmigiano Reggiano in different textures and temperatures, the crunchy part of lasagna, foie gras ice cream bar with traditional balsamic vinegar from Modena, and oops, I dropped the lemon tart vignola. My take: wow, each dish was so creative and exquisite. Massimo reinterprets traditional Italian dishes with artistry and sensibility. My favorite courses were the ones that I just mentioned, and my favorite moment was meeting Massimo. What a warm and charismatic man. The scene: quiet tables of fellow foodies. Perfect for food and restaurant lovers. Interesting tidbits. Massimo recently opened Refettorio Ambrosiano, a soup kitchen in Milan, as a part of the city's World Expo, using discarded food from the show to feed the poor. Some of the world's most renowned chefs, like Rene Rinzeppi and Daniel Hume, have dropped by to help out. Another tidbit: Massimo stars in Netflix's Chef's Table series with his wife, Laura. I watched his episode this past weekend, and it's wonderful. A must-see. Personal fun fact: Massimo invited me in the kitchen after my lunch, and as a gift gave me this giant chunk of over 30-month-old Parmigiano Reggiano cheese to take home. I'm not sure why I deserve this gift, but I feel very lucky, and I still haven't eaten it. So grazie mille, Massimo. The cost, I spent 215 euro, because I had bottled water and coffee. The tasting menu is 195 euro. Would I go back? Yes. Website, osteriafrancescana.it. Whew, so that was my long solo dining experience. Thank you for, Michelle, are you still there?
I am, and boy, did that sound awesome.
It was awesome. Have you been there? Do you know Massimo?
I have not been there. I've heard of Massimo. I'm hearing about him because everybody's coming back from, the James Beard, U.S. Pavilion and,
right.
and talking about it. So, yeah, I can't wait. I'm going out there in October. I can't wait.
Oh, great. I was out there for, this is the purpose of the trip was to go to the expo. So, I was there in the end of May and it was great. I'm impressed with this soup kitchen he's doing. I think, it's a guy who does more than run a fancy fine dining restaurant. So.
Yeah, chefs have a tendency to do that. We like feeding people, all people.
Yeah, no, good community, good industry.
Indeed.
Okay, so it's time for the final question. So next week, my guests are from Open Table. I'm having on Jen Pelka. She's the director of restaurant marketing, and Olivia Taranzio. She's the content marketing manager. So I want to see if you could ask them a question.
Yeah, I think I do want to ask them a question. We used Open Table at Dressing Room. It's a great program, and I'd love to see them get a little more into cause marketing and, adding a component where restaurants can easily, through Open Table and customers logging in through Open Table, can kind of connect their experience and some of the resources that result from their experience to go to favorite cause-based charities of their choice. I think that would be cool. Ask them if they're working on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Serious question here. No, that's great. That's really great.
They touch millions of people, so.
It's true. I've been a fan of Open Table for a long time, and they've grown and they've changed, and I'll see what they have to say about that.
Yeah, they can help change the world through food, too.
They certainly can.
And, awesome.
Yeah, and before I close, I just want to say, now I have to go back and listen to your archive shows that you did on Heritage Radio, It's More Than Food.
Yeah, that was so awesome. We did that for a while as we were leading up to the Farm Bill, just trying to open conversations up around, what the opportunities were, policy opportunities, that people could directly engage in and actually reclaim some of their democracy through food. So it was a cool show. I really enjoyed it. We got to look into getting back on.
Okay, well, I'll talk to Jack.
Yeah, there we go. Jack's the man.
Yeah, and I have to talk to Jack about getting my plaque. Because you have a plaque out in the little nook, and I don't.
Hey, tell him I want your plaque next to my plaque.
Okay. I think
All
he's
right,
listening.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, and I'm just honored to know you and everything you're doing. I think is amazing. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. So I've been talking to Michelle Nishan. He's the founder, CEO, and president of Wholesome Wave. Their website is wholesomewave.org. You can follow them on Twitter at Wholesome Wave and at Michelle Nishan. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry, at Heritage_Radio. My Facebook page is All in the Industry, and my website's BayerPublicRelations.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on Stitcher and iTunes, so you can listen to us as podcasts anywhere, anytime. You can also leave reviews of my show on iTunes, and I would love that, trying to get some more reviews up. So if you could take the time to do that, that would be great. Thanks always to my engineer, Jack, and to Michelle, and everyone listening. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next Wednesday at 4 with another live show. Till then, have a great week. Thanks for being part of All in the Industry.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.